My name is Ted Whiting. I should give you a little history about myself because some of my history is interwoven in my experiences. When I was young, very young, my mother and father were divorced. At that point in time, I didn't really know my dad. Throughout my life, up to the point where he died, I have only seen and spoke to him four times. When he died, he was murdered. Him and his friend and their two dogs were drowned. I can't go into a lot of details about that for fear, actually. Just the fact that I've told you that he was murdered should suffice. My stepdad and my mother, as far back as I can recollect, were alcoholics. And I grew up in a very different sort of way, a very violent, angry, history that I had as my young years, my teenage years. As a young adult, at one point my mother was told that she was going to die if she didn't stop drinking and smoking. At that point, that very day, she stopped. So she was, I guess, a recovered alcoholic, non-drinker, however you want to put it. She didn't drink anymore at that point. She lived another 12 years before she died. Now I can go into my first experience. My first experience was preceded by an accident. I was on a motorcycle, and I was 24 years old, and I was totally not prepared for the motorcycle accident. I was invincible. I was Superman. Nothing ever happened to me. And if anything did, I recovered or it didn't hurt me. However, this particular time, it did. I was driving my motorcycle on a day when motorcycles really weren't supposed to be on the road. It was the middle of winter. It was November 18th, 1978. And nobody was looking for motorcycles. And consequently, a young lady pulled out, and my motorcycle and her car collided, and I flew a great distance down the road. I landed on my head. It split my helmet. Fortunately, I was wearing a helmet, but it split the helmet right down the middle, evenly right down the middle. After I landed, I rolled an equal distance down the road, and from the time I was hit by the car and the time I stopped rolling, most of my clothes were ripped off. And I got up. I was very angry when I got up. There was a witness that came to see how I was, and he thought I was dead. And I stood up, and he was quite amazed that I stood up. And I just wanted to know who had hit me. And so he pointed at this young lady that was way down the road, and he said, "She hit you." And I was so angry. And then I went into shock. And that pretty much is the end of that experience. However, I got my motorcycle repaired. A year and 1 month later, I was in another motorcycle accident. And it wasn't nearly as dramatic. I was hit broadside. I was knocked right to the ground. And I was injured quite a bit more on that second accident. Because of those accidents, I suffered back problems. I got to the point where my back needed to be operated on. I had severe pain. I got to the point where I couldn't walk because of the pain in my back. And I was fortunate enough to find a doctor who was a neurosurgeon. He wasn't a back surgeon, he was a neurosurgeon, but he agreed to operate on me. So this is in 1981. I went to the hospital. It was in St. Mark's Hospital. The surgery was scheduled for 2 hours, and it lasted 5 hours. And some point between beginning and end, I died. I know I died because of the things that happened. So I can tell you a little bit about that experience now. When I died, I didn't see a bright light. I didn't go through a tunnel like a lot of people explain and a lot of things that I've heard. That didn't happen to me. I was dead, and I was gently placed down on the ground in front of my dead father. I say that I was gently placed on the ground because I wasn't dropped. I wasn't pushed. I wasn't anything else. It felt to me like I was placed on the ground, like somebody had carried me there and placed me on the ground. And there was my father, and he was dead. And I thought, if he's dead, then where am I? I pretty quickly concluded that I was dead too. And I spoke to my dad. The first thing he said to me was, "Ted, I'm so sorry." He said, "I'm sorry you have to go through this." I immediately said I don't want to go back, because the back pain before the operation was to the point where I pretty much couldn't stand it anymore. So our first conversation was he apologized to me, and I said, I don't want to go back. And he said, well, you've got to go back. At that point, I started to look around to see where I was. And it was a very nice day. It was pleasant. The sun was out. It wasn't cloudy. It wasn't sunny and bright. The sun wasn't beating down on me. It was nice and warm. It wasn't uncomfortably warm. It was just a nice warm day. And there was a very gentle breeze, just enough to where if you feel a breeze blowing and you know it's on you, it cools you just for that second. And so every once in a while I would feel that breeze. And where I was sat down was on a pathway, but the pathway was surrounded by grass. And it was on kind of a knoll. It was in a hilly area. If you were on the top of a road in the middle of nowhere and you were looking out across the valley and you could see the ups and the downs of the valley, I was on the top part of that. It wasn't extraordinarily covered in vegetation. It seemed like grass. Although I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. It was green. It was lush. It was comfortable. And I was on this path. And my dad said, we need to go for a walk. And I said, okay. And so I walked with my father. As I walked with my father, he apologized to me again. He said, I'm sorry I wasn't there for you. He said, I didn't mean it to be this way. He said, I'm not making an excuse. He said, I just apologize that I wasn't a good father. And I'm sorry that I wasn't there for you. I should have been there for you. And I should have helped raise you. And as we were walking on this pathway, that seemed the pathway was dirt. I mean, but it was very fine dirt. As we were walking, and we came up to a bench. It was a sandstone bench. And the bench was probably, it was maybe 3 feet long. And the sandstone itself was probably 8 or 10 inches thick. And then the supports for the sandstone bench were probably 8 or 10 inches thick. And it was probably maybe 20 inches deep. And he said, let's sit down and talk. And so we sat down there. And it was very comfortable. He said to me again, he says, I'm so sorry I wasn't there for you. And I said, well, it's okay. I don't hold that against you. I didn't. I didn't really know the guy. I had only seen him or spoke to him 4 times previously in my whole life. And as we were sitting there and we were talking, he said to me, he said, you know you have to go back. And I said, no, I don't want to go back. And I said, I don't want to go back to the pain. I said, that pain is more than I can handle. I don't want to go back to this pain. And he said, Ted, he says, you've got to go back. He called me again by my full name. My full name is Teddy. And he said, Teddy, he says, you've got to go back. He says, there's things you need to do. He says, you have 2 sons to raise. And at this point in time, I wasn't married. I didn't have a girlfriend. There was no prospects of kids. And I thought, well, that's a little weird. How would he even know that? As I was thinking that, he said, I've met your sons. He says, you have good sons. He said, they're great. They're great boys. And he said, don't do what I did. He said, go back and raise your sons. And I says, well, I says, I'm not married. I don't have a girlfriend. I don't have sons. I says, I don't want to go back. And he says, you have to go back. And he said, come on, we need to go back. And he walked me back to the place where I had met him. You need to go back now. And I said, no. I said, I don't want to go back. And he put his hands on my chest and he pushed me. And as he pushed me, I felt like I was being lifted up away from him. And I saw him as I was lifted, going up away from him. I saw him down in front of me. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in the hospital. I was in the intensive care unit. And the doctors, there was 2 doctors, the neurosurgeon and the anesthesiologist was there. And there were 2 nurses. And the doctor asked me, he said, Ted, he said, are you awake? He said, wake up. And the pain, I can tell you, the pain was excruciating. It was more even then than it was before the operation began. I immediately asked him for some pain medication. He says, you can't have any. He said, your blood pressure is too low. If we give you pain medication, you're going to die. And I said, but I already did die. And when I said that, he looked at the anesthesiologist and the 2 nurses looked at each other. And I thought, that's a little strange. Why are they doing that? He didn't answer me. He didn't say anything when I said I already did die. He just immediately looked at the anesthesiologist. The impression I got from that look, you can get this impression from anybody. When you see somebody and you're talking to them and they immediately look at you, you know something's up. And when he looked at the anesthesiologist looked at him, I knew something was up. I knew that they were worried about me, and I had probably died, and what I had experienced, I did experience. I have no idea how long that took, my experience. For me at the time, it seemed like I spoke to my dad for a half an hour to an hour from beginning to end. And for the next 5 days, I was without pain medication because my blood pressure wouldn't come up. Then I was put in a room where they put you after intensive care. I guess it's a critical room, I don't know. And they gave me pain medication, and I was a happy camper after that. I did recover from that operation, from that back operation. And the reason it took so long was because when he operated on me, he didn't expect to find what he found. And so because of that, the operation took so much longer. And I did recover. So my ability to become Superman and man recover from everything was still intact. I thought, this is great. As time goes on, if you're smart, you tend to realize that you're not Superman. You tend to take care of yourself a little better. If you're smart, this happens to you. And I didn't come to that point yet. I was a diesel mechanic years down the road. The second experience I had was in 1991. However, leading up to that, I became a diesel mechanic, and I was a very good diesel mechanic. I was fast, I could do the work, and the work is heavy. The work is very heavy, but I was very good at it. I could work circles around my friends. So again, I'm Superman, I'm the best of everything, I can do everything, and blah, 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 blah. As I'm still realizing that I'm superhuman and not superhuman, I was working on a diesel truck one day, and the diesel I was working on was the top of the diesel from the ground to the top was 12 and a half feet. So I was working on the air horn. The air horn wasn't working correctly, so I had to have a ladder. Climbed up the ladder, got on top of the truck, and fixed the air horn. And went back down, started up the truck, and tested the air horn. It worked just fine. Then I realized that I had left all my tools up on top of the truck. I shut the truck off, and I climbed down and climbed back up the ladder, and I grabbed my tools, and I stood up. And I don't remember another thing until one of the other workers was looking in my face and I was on the floor. And he said, what are you doing on the floor? And I said, I have no idea. I said, I don't know how I got here. I don't remember being on the floor. The last thing I remember was on the truck. And then I realized I had fallen off the top of the truck. I'm 6 foot tall. I'm on top of this truck that's 12 and a half feet. My head was 18 feet off the ground. I must have slipped. And I fell, and I landed on my head and my back. Now, that fall should have killed just about anybody. And they quite frequently, people fall, and they have head injuries, and they die from these head injuries with much less severe falls than this. So I was lucky. I don't know why. But the injuries from that fall were quite severe, and it took me almost 15 years to overcome those injuries. And I still suffer quite a bit from the injuries in that fall of that truck. However, I got up and walked away. I had lots of bruises and pains. I've had several operations because of that fall. And as I said, I still suffer from the effects of that accident. But one of the effects of that accident, when I hit my head, and I've realized from research in head injuries that I have done since then, because I hit my head so hard, that when you hit your head, your brain bounces inside your head. It doesn't just get injured on one side. There's a recoil injury. Your head is like quite a bit like a tennis ball. If you bounce a tennis ball, it comes back up into your hand, and your brain is quite a bit like that. If your brain bounces off of one part of your skull, it recoils and it hits the other part of your skull. So you wind up with two injuries. You wind up with the injury where you made contact with whatever it is you made contact with, and the recoil injury is on the opposite side. And it took the people that study head injuries quite a long time to figure out why is this person suffering from a head injury when he wasn't injured in that part of his head? It was very interesting how the doctor found out. He was at his desk doing research, and he was bouncing a ball on his desk. And as he was bouncing the ball, it came to him, this is why you suffer from injuries in your brain on the opposite side of your head. And they find that they call this a recoil injury. Because of that head injury, for a while, I could only see black and white. That was interesting. I couldn't make sense of a lot of things. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't drive down the road and know where I was going, because I would get lost. And I would call my wife and I'd say, I don't know where I am. And quite often she was mad because I was supposed to be delivering things, and so that upset the delivery schedule just a little bit. I lost a little bit of vision in my left eye. When I hit the floor, my jaw had bounced back and hit my inner ear. So I have lost hearing in my right ear, and it still creates problems with hearing and dizziness that I still suffer. Another injury that was part of that head injury that was not visible, and nobody knew anything about it, was my sinuses were damaged quite severely. And your sinuses in your head, they're meant to be kind of an air conditioning system for your head and a drainage system. Well, I had damaged this drainage system and this air conditioning system. There's little flaps inside your brain, inside your skull. There's little flaps. They're like one-way valve. And when you get a sinus infection, the infection pushes through, and the valve stops, and the sinus infection pushes through, and that's how you get drainage in your head. That's why you blow your nose and you clean it out, and your head feels better for a while. When I had a head injury, it damaged those valves. They no longer work. So I got a sinus infection. In between the time that I had the fall and the time that I got the sinus infection, I started going to school. I was at Salt Lake Community College. I got a pretty bad headache. It was substantial for one day, 2 days, 3 days, and then it got to the point where I couldn't stand the headache any longer. And I didn't know it, but I had contracted a sinus infection. But I had this terrible headache. And I called my younger brother to pick me up. I couldn't wait for my wife to get off of work wherever she was. I couldn't wait for her. I asked my younger brother to pick me up and take me home. When he took me home, by the time I got home, I was vomiting from the pain of the sinus infection. The pain was much worse than the back pain. I couldn't even tell you how much worse the pain was in my head from the sinus infection compared to the back pain. I told my younger brother, I said, I can't stay here. I said, take me to the hospital. So he took me to St. Mark's. By this time, they're getting to know me pretty well. It took me to St. Mark's, and I couldn't walk. I couldn't get out of the car. So they carried me out of the car. They put me on a wheelchair. They wheelchaired me into the hospital, put me on a gurney. And at that point in time, the pain was so severe in my head, I just didn't want to be alive. I just let go, and I gave up, and I died. And again, I didn't go through a light. I didn't go through a tunnel. But what happened was I was in water. And I came up through this pond, and as I was coming to the surface in this pond, I could see some relatives. I saw one of my aunts, and then I saw another one of my aunts, and there was three of my aunts that were very close together. One of them was my favorite, and they were all great people. And as I was coming to the surface of the water, I saw a whole bunch of people, and I knew them all. But the ones that were closest to me was my Aunt Maud, and she was quite a character. As I was coming up to the surface of the water, and my head popped out of the water, and I wasn't swimming. I don't remember swimming, but I remember coming to the edge of the water and climbing out of the water. She reached down and grabbed me, and she called me Tedder. And she was one of only two people in my life that ever called me Tedder. She had died probably 3 or 4 years before this of liver cancer. I was with her when she died. My bond to that aunt was pretty good. And the other aunt that was with her was Aunt Margaret, and there was Aunt Bell, and there were a lot of my relatives that were there. And I had friends that were there, too. I had a friend that had died when I was 17 years old. He was quite a, you know, when I was 17, that was in the 60s, and so that's kind of the mid-hippie era. And he was a pretty good hippie, and he died because of that. He died because of drug-related injuries as a hippie. And he was there. And he was happy to see me, and I was happy to see him, but I didn't speak to him. The only one I spoke to was Aunt Margaret and Aunt Maud. And as soon as I got out of the water, Aunt Maud said, "Tedder, Tedder, Tedder." She said, "You can't be here." And I said, "Well, I'm not going back." I said, "The pain is too severe." And I said, "I'm glad to be here." And I said, "I'm not going back." And she said, "You have to go back." And I said, "I'm not going back." I don't know if there was a pause. Maybe there was a pause. Maybe people were trying to figure out what they were going to do with me. At any rate, I looked around again to see where I was. And where I was not on a knoll like where I was with my dad. But I would be down in the valley of an area. And there was the pond that I came out of was not small. It wasn't big. It wasn't like a lake. But it was a pond. And the water was comfortable. I don't know what the temperature was, but I was comfortable. I mean, it was great. I mean, you could go swimming in there and you'd be just fine. And I came out of there onto the ground, and I didn't come out onto mud or rocks. I came out onto grass. And it smelled so fresh. The air was so fresh. Like when you drive up in the mountains and you smell just fresh air. It's not the pollution that we smell down here. Or if you're so used to the air down here and you drive in the mountains and then you smell that fresh air, that's what I smelt. And again, the day was bright and sunny. The sun wasn't visible to me, but it was nice and bright and it was warm and it was great and the breeze was just fine. And I didn't want to go back. And I looked off in the distance and I could see trees, like maybe not a forest, but there was trees out in the background. And again, I said to my aunt, I said, "No," I said, "there's no way I'm going back." I said, "I'm not going back to that pain." I said, I gave up. That's unusual for me because I don't give up on anything. But the pain was so severe, I couldn't stand it. And I gave up. And I felt kind of ashamed because I gave up. But my aunt said, "Tedder, there's no way you're staying here. You've got things to do. There's people relying on you. You've got to go back." And I said, "Aunt Maud," I said, "I can't go back. I don't want to go back." And she said, "Yes, you can." And she put her hands on my chest and she pushed me back in the water. And I thought, "Aunt Maud, I'm not happy with you." It wasn't like I could fight that. I remember throwing my arms back and splashing into the water, and I was backing up, and as I was backing up, I was going back down into the water, and as I was going into the water, they were becoming distant from me, and they were standing there, and I could see tears coming down from their eyes. And then I was on the gurney in the hospital in a great amount of pain, and they were working on me to bring me back. And then I was operated on, and the operation was again much longer than they thought it was going to be. And the operation was terrible. It saved my life. I'm here. I don't longer think that I'm Superman. I don't longer think that I'm immortal. I don't think that I can't be injured. I'm very careful about being injured now. So I did learn that there is an end to being immortal. And that's pretty much about the size of my experiences. I guess now would be the time to ask you if you have questions.
Did you have two sons? Or have you got two sons?
I do have two sons, and they are great boys.
All right. All right. Thank you.
So my question is, in both cases, both with your father and with the other people that you came into contact with, your other relatives, I'm kind of curious as to whether you noticed what people were wearing. Was it what you remembered them in, or was it something different? Or
It's interesting that you thought about it. My dad was wearing a white shirt. It seems like the pants that he was wearing were maybe a very light beige color. Very, very casual. My aunt was always, both of them were always dressed up very elegantly, as if they were on their way to a formal occasion or something, and they were dressed like that. However, the friend of mine, the one that died, he was dressed like he was the last time I had seen him. Just Levi's and a shirt, and he seemed very comfortable.
So once a hippie, always a hippie, I guess.
Well, I was a hippie, so I'm not a hippie now. I could probably revert.
when you were told, you've got to go back, you're going to have sons, and you go, no, I don't even have a girlfriend or anything, and all of a sudden you jump to, you had a wife. So you kind of skipped a time period there.
The time frame when my dad told me I had to go back and I was going to have sons, that was 1981. From 1981 to 1991, there were a lot of things that happened to me. However, in 1991, I was a diesel mechanic. That was the, and I was in the shop where the accident happened, and that seemed to me to be the most pertinent part of the story, so I didn't talk about anything in between. When I did get married, I told my wife we were going to have two sons, and she said, there's no way, I don't want kids, and we did have two sons.
Did you have any more kind of a spiritual contact with your Aunt Maud or with your father since that time that you died and came back?
I have not had any sort of contact with my father since then, or my Aunt Maud, or any other persons that I have seen in either one of those experiences. However, I think about them quite a bit, but I have not had any more contact with them.
Okay, thank you.
I was curious about the part where you said you kind of gave up in the second experience, and I didn't know if that meant you were in such pain that you gave up, or did you have other things that were wrong with you is why you...
I had a lot of other injuries from that accident. The sinus injury and the head pain was quite a surprise. I gave up. I'll explain a little to you about sinuses when they're closed off and you get a sinus infection. Your skull is a very interesting thing. You know, it houses your brain. Your skull doesn't just float around in your head, however. There you have an inner skull. So your sinuses are in between your inner skull and your outer skull. When you get an infection, the reason you get a headache is because the sinus infection grows and it pushes on nerves. You have nerves that are on the interior part of your inner skull. You have nerves that are on the interior part of your outer skull. So my sinuses were closed off. The infection continued to grow and continued to grow and continued to grow. And it was creating a hydraulic pressure, and it was putting pressure on my brain. And my inner skull was actually cracking. And I wasn't going to survive. Had I not been operated on that day, I wouldn't have survived. That part of my skull would have ruptured, and I would have died.
The reason why I ask this, I asked a doctor before, or a nurse, can you die from pain? And when you said you just gave up, I wondered if it was the pain that was so horrible, that if pain can actually kill you, or if it's the other circumstance.
I don't know if you can die from pain. I don't know. I know that I didn't want to hurt as badly as I did. The pain was so severe. It got to the point where I didn't want anybody around me even touching my hair. I didn't want to see light. I closed my eyes. I didn't want to hear a noise. I didn't want to hear the doctors talking to me. I wouldn't hardly answer their questions. I don't know. How would you give up? How can I explain that you gave up? But I did. I just let go. I just couldn't stand it anymore. And maybe at that point, maybe it was killing me. I don't know. But I gave up.
Ted, I have one question. Were there any changes that came about in your life? Any changes that you noticed in your attitudes towards things as a result of your experiences?
There were. There are several changes, actually. One of them is, as you live, if you live long enough, and I don't say that I've lived that long, but as you live long enough, you have a chance to look back on your life. I did that. I looked back on my life. At some points in my life, I would have things happen to me, and I'd get very, very angry, and I would say, why is this happening to me? And I would have a conversation with God that was mostly kind of one-sided, because I don't know that he answered me. He probably would have just zapped me with a lightning bolt if he did answer me anyway, because I was pretty pissed. I would get very angry about things that happened to me, and I would say, why? You know, why is this happening? What is the purpose of this? As I look back, now that I've lived long enough, I look back and I see these things that have happened to me. And I see what's happened afterwards. And I can get the connection. I can say almost without a doubt, I can't even think of a time that I've looked back and I've seen these terrible things that have happened, or maybe not necessarily terrible things, maybe misfortunate things that have happened to me, and I can look at the outcome and I can say, that's why this happened. That's why this happened. This happened here, so this over here could happen. And it changed my whole attitude. Now I don't look at things. Now I don't get so upset. When something bad happens to me now, I'm just very curious and very glad that I'm still alive for one thing, but I'm very curious to say, I can't hardly wait to find out why this has happened. What's the point of this? So I did a complete 180 with my outlook on things and my anger. It solved my anger problem quite a bit. Not entirely, but quite a bit. There was another thing that came about because of that. When my dad apologized to me, he didn't make excuses. He didn't say, well, I did this because of this, and I did this because of this. He didn't sound like a wimp. He didn't sound like he was trying to undo everything and make excuses. He just simply said, I apologize, and please forgive me. And that taught me quite a lesson. As my life progressed, and my mother and my father were alcoholics, as I say, my dad, he was a great big man. He was very, very strong, a big person. When my mother got drunk, let me back up just a little bit. When my mother was inebriated, when she got drunk, she would turn from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde. She was terribly violent. She was a sweet person when she wasn't drunk. When she was drunk, she was extremely violent. It was terrible to be around her. My dad, however, when he got drunk, he was what they call a happy drunk. So when he got drunk, he was just happy. However, my mom, being the violent person that she was when she got drunk, she would attack my dad. My dad, being the person that he was when he got attacked, he responded. Even though he was a happy drunk, he responded. The last time that he did that, he put my mother in the hospital. She almost died. This was on my graduation night of my high school graduation. I came home and found her bleeding and almost dead in the kitchen. As my life went on from there, you know, there was good and bad things that happened. But because of the fact that my natural father had apologized to me and asked me to forgive him, was able to forgive my stepdad. And I had a conversation with him. And I told him, I said, you know, I said, you've done some pretty bad things. I said, but I forgive you. And you know why I did that? I did that because of the weight of anger, and the weight of hatred, and the weight of all those things in between, it was killing me. It was weighing me down. And when I told my dad that I forgave him, it was like that weight disappeared. It was almost as if I could float. It was almost as if I could fly. That weight disappeared. And I truly forgave him. And I told him I forgave him. And his words to me were, I didn't ask you to forgive me. And I said, it's not up to you. I forgive you anyway. Whether you ask or not, I forgive you. It's an interesting thing. As my life progressed and my stepfather died, I was there when my stepfather died. And the last people that he actually spoke to was myself and my two sons. And then he died. And he had his hand on my arm. And even when he was dying, he was much, much stronger than I was. He almost crushed my arm just before he died.
Ted, I want to, first of all, you pretty well answered my question about what you learned from these experiences, and I believe I heard you say there are no coincidences or accidents that you learned. There was a purpose in them. What biggest great thing are you grateful for in having your experiences? And you've started sharing some of that. But
one of the things I was grateful for is I had that conversation with my father. Another one of the things I'm grateful for is I had the conversation with my aunt because I liked her a lot. My dad I didn't know. And he was able to express his care for me. Another thing that happened when I had my conversation with my dad, I said, well, you're dead. I said, you drowned. And he said, yes, I did. And I said, well, does that hurt? And he said, it only hurts the first breath. When you intake that water the first time in your lungs, he said, that's the only time it hurts. He said, after that, it's not bad. He says, so don't be concerned about the way I died. He said, it wasn't really that bad. So I'm not afraid of drowning. I'm actually not afraid of dying either. Because of those two experiences, I've learned that if you took a pen, like you, ma'am, you've got a pen, there's a lot of people writing here. If you take that pen and you put a dot on your paper, just very lightly, you put a dot on your paper, okay, that dot compared to eternity is nothing. Our life here is that dot. It's even less than that dot, because eternity is a long, long, long time. And that was the sense I got when I was dead, and I found out that there was more besides death, and there were people there. And I found out this sense of eternity, because there were these people that I saw that were dead that I hadn't seen before. And I'm not afraid of death. In fact, I can say, to my satisfaction, there's absolutely no fear in dying. Nobody should be afraid of death. It's as if you were going to visit your friends, and you got on an airplane, and your friends are in a different state, and you go visit your friends, and you're flying, and that's death. You go through this short period of time, this bewilderment of where you are to your friends, and they are there for you. People would ask me, how can that be? How can your friends be there? How do they know that you're there? How do they know that you're going to die? Well, you know what? Time here for us, 80 years, 90 years, 100 years here for us, seems like a long time. Time for people on the other side of death is seconds. They know where we're going to be. They turn around and it's time for us to be there. They already know where to meet us. It's not a mystery for them. And it's a very gratifying thing to know that you can see people and that you can go there and you can expect your friends and your loved ones to come and meet you, and that you're going to see them. It's a very comforting thing to know that. I mean, it is for me.
Something struck me about what you said during your visit with your father. He told you you're going to have two sons, and then he went on to say that he had met them and he knew them. Can you elaborate? Was there any more discussion? And I'm kind of curious as to how he went about describing that to you.
He only told me that I needed to go back. There were things I needed to do. I needed to take care of my two sons, and that I was going to have two sons. He knew I was going to have two sons, and he had met them. I didn't ask him how he met them, and he didn't say. So I can't answer that question. I wish I could go back and ask him, though.
I wondered if you had a religious or spiritual background.
I was agnostic, atheist, antisocial, public enemy number one until I was 19 years old. And I had a religious experience that was brought on by a friend of mine. I became converted to the LDS religion. And that's a whole other story.
I wonder if you could try to compare your consciousness, for example, in this setting to here tonight, compared to the setting in which you were in with your father and your aunts. How would you compare those two states of consciousness?
Well, you and I are here. I can see you. I can speak to you. I can walk over and touch you. I can do that with my father. This area that we're in right now is not as nice as where I was. I was totally aware of what was going on. I could smell, I could see, I could hear, I could feel what was under my feet. And by the way, I was barefoot. My father wasn't barefoot, however. I was barefoot. When I came up out of the water with my aunt, again, I was barefoot. I didn't have shoes on. Consciousness means, are you aware of what's going on around you? I am aware. When I woke up from my back operation, the first one, I didn't want to be there. I really didn't. I knew where I was. How can you compare? How can you say you're conscious? Pinch myself. I could have pinched myself there. Very real. And these experiences, they're fresh in my mind. One of them happened in 1981. How long ago was that? That was 20, 34 years ago. The other one happened in 1991. I'm starting to get old. Yeah, they're very fresh in my mind. There's not a soul here that would tell me it didn't happen.
We have heard from others that have had your experience on the other side of the veil, that they felt a tremendous sense of love and that they saw the Savior while they were there. Did you experience that incredible love?
I experienced the love, a sense of peace. I didn't see the Savior. I don't think I had a chance to see the Savior. They got me out of there too fast. However, I did feel this sense of peace and no pain and sense of well-being. I was very, very comfortable. If that's a sense of love, it is. You know, when you're around those you love and you feel this care for you, I felt that. I felt this care for me.
How long did you perceive in each of your experiences the length of time that you were
participating in these experiences versus how long you were actually out?
I have no idea how long I was out. When I spoke to my dad, it seemed like it was a half an hour, 45 minutes that we chatted. I don't know how long that compared to being dead. I don't know. The doctor wouldn't tell me. They would not even broach the subject of me dying. And neither did those two nurses. When I spoke to my aunt, the time was much shorter. She got me out of there pretty fast. It was about, I would say, about 15 minutes if I had to measure the time now.
Some dreams that we have are very, very vivid. How would you distinguish a dream in relation to the experience that you had?
No comparison. Absolutely no comparison.
No comparison.
I would say this. If you told me about your day, you were driving down the freeway and somebody gave you a certain hand gesture and you're upset about it and you kept going, how would I know if that was real? You wouldn't know it was real, but I wouldn't know it was real. How can I compare that? You're telling me what happened to you. I'm telling you what happened to me. For me, it was real. It wasn't a dream. I've had all kinds of dreams. One of my favorite dreams is being a basketball player, and I can jump like 40 feet in the air, and I'm shooting down at the basket. And that's a dream. It's unrealistic. This was nothing like that. This was totally, I was unprepared for anything like this.
So the consciousness was just totally different?
Absolutely different. It was as if we were here. I can see my dad right now sitting here or conversing with me right now. And I had only seen him four times in my entire life.
Based upon your experience, there's a purpose behind everything that happens, good or bad.
Yes. Based on my experience, that's exactly what I found out. There's a purpose behind it. If you live long enough, I've lived long enough to question that. And I've looked back, and I found a purpose for everything that has happened to me. And there's a few things that have happened to me now. I'm still waiting for the other end of it to find out what's the good side. What's going to happen here? Come on, you know, let's get it going. I want to find out what's going to happen. And so, yeah, there is a purpose.
In the settings you were in both occasions, did you notice anything that you were able to perceive through any one of your senses or with your communication with the people you were interacting with there that's different than life here?
The thing that I noticed different more than anything else was the sunlight. Because on a nice, bright, sunny day, most of the times you can see the sun. The thing that I noticed different was I couldn't see the sun. It was just a nice, beautiful, sunny day. However, I couldn't distinguish the sun anywhere. And I did look. I remember looking in the sky. I remember looking all over. But I couldn't see the sun. And there were no clouds.
What else did you see? Did you see trees? Did you see any buildings?
I saw the first time with my dad, I saw only vegetation. It was like ground cover, like grass. And I don't know if it was grass or not. I didn't step on it. It appeared to be grass. The path I was on was very nicely trimmed. With him, I didn't see any trees. With my aunt, the second time in 1991, I did see trees off in the distance. However, the vegetation on the ground was the same. I didn't see bushes. I just saw grass. It just seemed like that was the place to be. But I do remember with my aunt, I remember looking back into the water, and the water didn't look cold, it looked inviting. And I remember looking back and seeing the pond. But as I said before, it wasn't like a pond. You know, you get the idea of a pond that it's kind of small. It wasn't small, it wasn't a lake, but it was quite large. And I remember looking across that, seeing the ripples, just very gentle ripples in the water, and it looked very inviting.
Did you see any animals?
I saw no animals. I only saw people. I went with my aunt, however. There were a lot of people there, and they were all there for me. There was a crowd of people. However, I only spoke to my aunt.
This is kind of silly, but when you were in the water, were you soaking wet when you came out of the water?
I was drowned.
You were soaking wet?
I was wet to the bone when I got out of the water.
And do you think they pushed you back because you wouldn't have gone back?
I was not going to go back.
On either time?
No
so
way.
They had to get you?
No, I wasn't. I was on my way there. There was no way I was going to come back. However, now, I'm glad that I did. I'm glad they gave me a little shove, And I'm glad that I have my two sons, and I'm glad I've lived the life that I've led. I still don't know if I was to be brought back to raise my sons, if there's more in my life that needs to be done. I don't know. I don't know the impact I have on people. I very seldom talk about these things to people. In fact, up to this point, probably you could count to the number of people I told this experience to on one hand, and now there's a zillion people here.
You've obviously had many takeaways from this, and your faith has grown tremendously. What would be one or two things that you could tell us or people around you how to live better or differently because of your experience? Something that we haven't experienced that you have that could help us. I don't know if you understand that.
But. I do understand that. The thing that I experienced most that I could tell a lot of people is forgive. Don't hold a grudge. And the guy's going down the road and he's flipping you off. Let him go. Maybe there's a reason that he's flipping you off. Maybe he's in a terrible hurry to get to the hospital to go help his son. Or maybe he's just having a bad day. His boss is on his back. Just let it go. Forgive that person. Just find a reason to forgive him. It's just not worth it to hang on to the anger, that animosity. And the other thing, as I said before, there is absolutely nothing to be afraid of death. I mean, when it's time, I'm ready. Take me. I'm just looking forward to it. There's nothing to be afraid of to die.
We really appreciate you being here to share your experience, but I had one small question. That was, did you speak telepathically to your aunt and to your dad, or was it words out of your mouth?
It was verbal. It wasn't telepathic. It was verbal. And my dad was very gentle, and my aunt was not. My aunt was kind of like that, though. And my aunt was also only one of two people that ever called me Tedder. My older brother called me Tedder when I was a little kid, and my aunt always referred to me as Tedder.
I'm wondering if you came back with any gifts. Do you feel like you have in any way more extrasensory perception or better intuition or any gifts that you feel you may have picked up as a result of crossing over? Do you think you're brighter in some ways?
Well, I always thought I was smart.
Yeah, sounds
but,
like
it. Because of the injury that I had the second time falling off the truck, I was tested several times, and my IQ was measured several times. I have a very high IQ. It would be bragging to tell you what that is. However, some of the things that have happened to me that I came back with, I couldn't tell you that. I wouldn't. I mean, I could, but I won't. It's very personal.
I just thought it was interesting that you said when you were going back into the water that your aunt was crying, or the people there were crying. I guess I just didn't realize they were that emotional, or I don't know, I guess it's silly to think that they are always happy in heaven or wherever they're at, whatever realm, but because they can foresee what's coming down the road like your dad did, that you'd have two boys, I would think that they would know that everything is going to work out all right. Maybe they were crying because they were sad to leave. For you to leave them, or that you would go back into so much pain? I don't know if you have a comment for that, but I just thought that was interesting.
I do, and it's interesting you would ask that, because there's two senses of that that I have. One of them is they were tears of joy that they had for me, and the other one were they were tears of sadness that I was going back to the pain that I was in. Nobody would choose that pain.
You mentioned how you... You're not afraid of death, and I understand that, but aren't you anxious or aren't you interested in staying here as long as you can, especially to be here for your boys and maybe grandchildren and be here for your friends?
Well, I'm very interested in staying here. I'd like to live to be 200 years old, maybe longer. I hope that by the time I get up to where it's going to be dying or science has figured out a way I can stay alive, I'll stay alive as long as I can. However, when it comes to the time that I have to die, or that I know I'm going to die, I'll take it. I'm not going to push it. I'm not on my way to it. I'm not running towards it.
You mentioned that you've only shared so far your experiences with very few people. I was wondering if you'd ever have it in the written form, if you've written about it, or other than just orally, if you've written a book or have a website or anything like that.
I like to stay off the grid, so I have no website. I really don't have enough time for a website or all that stuff. I really don't. I do a lot of things, and for me, by the time I get done doing what I'm doing throughout the day, I don't have time for that. And that doesn't interest me anyway. I actually did write it down. I wrote quite a bit about it. I wrote 5 books about it, and after I went back and read them, I threw them all in the garbage. I didn't want anybody to read them, so I threw them away.
Something that I've been wondering about, I don't know if it was revealed to you, but was there anything about nutrition, you know, the way we've been, or how we should treat our bodies better while we're here on the earth? Was any of that given to you or anybody else that you've talked to?
In those experiences, that wasn't something that I experienced. I was just merely told to go back. They didn't tell me why, other than I had to raise my sons. But they didn't mention nutrition. I didn't really address anything like that. Since then, oh my gosh, the doctors. If I follow the nutritional habits that the doctors have given me, they gave me a great big list of things not to do. They gave me a big list of things not to eat. If I do the things I'm not supposed to do, and if I eat the things I'm not supposed to eat, I'm not going to do anything, and I'm not going to eat anything, and I'm going to die. So I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to eat what I want to eat.
I can answer or address that a little bit. A couple of years ago, I invited a woman to come and speak here. Her last name was Reeves, and she died from cancer. At least she had cancer when she died. She said she met the Savior, and he told her that she needed to go back and eat her vegetables. Okay, so something to come to keep in mind. Actually, the research, I'm an Alzheimer's researcher, and that's one of the primary bits of information that's coming out of the research now, particularly from Europe, is we need to eat our vegetables.
Now, see, I've been told to eat my vegetables, and the doctors have given me a list of vegetables not to eat, and depending on the doctor, I can't eat any vegetables, so what do you do?
Just eat your vegetables, that's it.
That's what I do. I eat anyway, to heck with it.
I'd like to thank Ted for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.